Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate Australian author Catherine McNamara, who now resides in the Veneto region in Italy. Catherine's stories can be found in Ellipsis Zine, Fictive Dream, Jellyfish Review, Flash Fiction Magazine, Bucanista, and Litro, among others. She has twice had stories selected for Wig Leaf's Top 50 Very Short Fictions. Catherine's fourth short story collection, The Carnal Fugues, published by Puncher & Wattman Australia, will be released in October of this year. Today, I'll be reading her story, The Bamboo Furnace. But first, let's listen to my interview with Catherine, which took place on August 16th of this year. I'd like to welcome Catherine McNamara to the podcast. How are you today, Catherine?
Fine, very warm, and everything's fine, thank you.
Yes, this is August in Italy. And what city are you in Italy?
Okay, I live between outside of Vicenza, which is in the northeast. It's about 40 kilometers from Venice, but it's in the middle of the countryside where I'm living.
And how you got to this place is, I think, of great interest, or will be of great interest to the people listening to the podcast. So before we get into talking about your stories and your creative process, why don't you take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I grew up in Sydney, but I always wanted to travel and I always wanted to write. And I actually always wanted to live in Paris. And so I did. I sort of ran away, I think, from the destiny that was sort of ahead for me in Australia. And I did. I ran away to Paris and began to write. I worked as an au pair for a couple of years in Paris, and I had studied French in high school and at university. So I thought I could speak French, but actually I couldn't. And I realized that when I began to live with a family and sort of deal with everything that you deal with every day. And in Paris, I guess I started to write short stories, which I'd always wanted to write. I read a lot when I was growing up. I spent a lot of time on my own contemplating reading and wanting to write. That was my big sort of plan, really. And then I stayed. I didn't come home. That's what happened. I stayed in Paris. I had no intention of going back to Australia. I made my parents very, very angry because I did not finish university. And I sort of went to the University of Life and later on Hard Knocks. That's what also happened. And then I got married very young, ended up living in Italy, and then we went to Africa. So I spent a long time there. I spent 13 years there. I lived in Somalia originally before the war, and then in Belgium for a while, in Italy for a while. And then my longest stay really, I guess, was in Ghana, where I lived for 10 years and traveled a lot around West Africa. So that was home for me for a very long time. And as I had family ties in Italy and a house here, I ended up coming back to Italy to sort of finish raising my children, who are now big, very big. And writing. I've been writing the whole time, publishing for a long time too, publishing lots of short stories.
And the family ties that you have in Italy, are they through your family or through your husband's family?
No. My sort of family origin would be Irish and English and German. We have no Italian blood at all. And everybody can see that straight away when they look at me here. No, I was married to an Italian guy from Vicenza. So my kids are half and half. And so some of them, three of them are still living here. So yeah, Italy is sort of home. It's been home for a really long time. I don't feel at home if I go home to Australia now. I feel a little bit like a fish out of water.
And you have siblings. Are they still in Australia?
Yes. I have two brothers and they're still in Australia. They're not creative people, so they don't read what I write. And I have one, my youngest has decided to live in Australia. So I do go to Australia quite often because of that. My mum's on her own, so I visit her as much as I can. So yeah, I haven't really tried to publish in Australia. And that's what, you know, the interesting thing about is concerning this book that's coming out in October, because that's coming out in Australia. But normally I publish in the UK and in the US.
You have a publisher for this collection of stories in Australia, this newest collection, which is called...
It's called The Carnal Fugues.
Yes, The Carnal Fugues. I love that title.
Thank you.
So you have designs on getting it distributed in all English-speaking countries for starts, and hopefully translated into many languages after that, right?
Well, as you know, and as your listeners probably know, it's very hard to push a short story collection out there. So I'll be behind it as much as possible. This publisher is Australia-based, and this edition will be coming out in English, but we do have hopes to try and get it translated. My dream would be to have the stories published in Italian, because I'm living here, and other European languages. I would really like that. So I think we'll try and see. It's an independent publisher, so he's doing really well actually at the moment and has had quite a few translations done. So I hope that will happen. We'll see. We'll see. But at the moment, for the moment, it's coming out in Australia. That's it.
And what is the release date? Is it scheduled?
Yeah, it's coming out on October the 1st. And if any of your listeners are in Sydney in November, I'll be doing a launch in mid-November, on the 17th of November in Sydney. So anyone who's in Sydney, please contact me, join me.
Wow, so you'll be heading back to Australia in the fall, okay?
That's right.
For your book.
Back down.
That's wonderful. Well, I hope this book does really well and that we get to see it here in the States. I mean, there is always a way to get it, thank goodness, because of the internet. But I would love to see it on the shelves here in the States at some point. Just to get back to Italy for a moment, you do something in Italy that I learned about through social media. Can you talk a little bit about the retreat that you have there in Italy during the summer?
Yeah, sure. My kids have left the house. The house is very big and the house is very beautiful. And I've put a lot of work into this house, as in painting, decor. When I lived in Ghana, I actually had an art gallery. So I have a lot of traditional art and photography here. And so the house is sort of a little bit like an art gallery. So one of the dreams that I had as I was, you know, pushing the kids out one by one was to make the house into, a place for writers. And I know how hard it is to focus on editing and even getting down first draft. And so the old sort of, it's an old stable that was converted into a great big bedroom. That's the room where writers come. And I usually have writers come one at a time and they stay for perhaps 5 nights. And during that time, I leave them on their own to work, or if they need to talk, they talk about their projects. If they do need mentoring, I do mentoring as well. And then to break up the sort of rhythm and the intensity, I can take them hiking or walking or to Venice, because Venice is quite close by. So I usually sort of tailor the stay according to what the writer's needs are. You know, people who need to eat in a certain way or drink in a certain way or think in a certain way. So it all comes down to whatever the writer wants. Because I know that's something that I would have liked moving along. It's not really expensive. It's not one of those sort of luxury trips to a villa in Italy. It's a farmhouse. It's not a villa. And I've had a lot of Americans and internationals, English people. So really interesting people. I've had wonderful people come so far. It's been a really interesting, sort of joyful summer. I've had some great guests.
Yes, so it's as I've told you before, it sounds like heaven to me. So, and how do you find these students?
I don't advertise because I don't want too many people. It sounds a tiny bit selective, but really it's just because it's sort of intimate and intense. I don't want, like, it's not a tourist thing. It's actually people who are doing the same thing that I'm doing. So they would be working, revising, editing, thinking. So it's sort of that type of person who usually stumbles upon it. I think if you Google writer's retreat in Italy, I think it comes up. But I'm not really into hard advertising. And a lot of people who follow me on social media, they find out about it or they know about it anyway. So for me, that's the volume is fine. I don't think I could cope with too many people. And in winter, my house is quite cold. So I don't really push it in the wintertime because I'm used to the cold, but some people, maybe they can't handle country cold.
Yeah, summer is definitely the season, I think, for conducting something like that, especially especially in a place like Italy, as hot as it probably gets there. And you do everything yourself? You like run the whole show there?
Yeah, that's why it takes a lot of energy. And that's why I'm happy with the rhythm that I have. Yeah, I had I have four kids, so I'm used to doing everything. It's stressful, really. I cut the grass. Okay, I have gardeners come at the beginning of the season when there's too much work and it's too much sort of back heavy labor. But no, I do the garden. The garden's big. I enjoy doing the garden. And the house is already set up, really. It's sort of set up for guests all the time.
And you cook the meals too. That was like what I was something I was really curious about, because in your stories, meals are an important part of many of your stories, and you seem to know a lot about food and cuisine. So I just had this feeling you probably are a good cook.
No, I wouldn't call myself a high-end chef or anything like that. More like local and traditional food and food that's in season, and it's actually really healthy. And so many people have come this year who've been vegetarian or wanting to eat light, or it's very hot, so they don't want to eat a lot of food anyway. So it's not really challenging for me. It's sort of fun. I get to try out new recipes, and I go to Greece a lot, and Italian food's very seasonal. It's very sort of easy to cook, I think.
And you probably have a lot of local fresh produce and stuff that is of the higher of a higher quality than most of us are used to shopping at
Oh, yeah. I
supermarkets.
actually put sort of an effort into that, and I get organic fruit and vegetables, and the wine is local. It's very good. If people want meat, I do organic stuff. I mean, I'm not sort of fixated on it, but yeah, definitely healthy.
It really does sound like an experience that I'm sure any writer would just be thrilled to experience. This will be a little advertisement for you.
Thank
I don't think our
you.
reach is so great that you have to worry about being overwhelmed with requests, but
That's okay. That's perfect like that. It's really perfect.
I think it's nice for people to know about this
Yeah, thank
through
you.
this kind of an outlet, at least, which is kind of a niche thing. So yes, I w wish you continued success with that. And
Thank you. But sorry, I'll just add something. But one of the really nice things is a lot of my friends here, they're not writers. And so it's really nice to actually have writers in the house. And so you're talking short stories and you're talking beginnings and endings, you're talking publishing, you're talking, all of the sort of business side of working with literature. And so I find that really stimulating, really, because everybody comes from a slightly different place, thinking wise. And so it's really enriching for me as well. I think everybody goes home happy. So
Well,
it's really good.
then it sounds like you're providing an amazing service there, Catherine. I envied all of those people who have had an opportunity to be there and experience that. But I do want to talk about the stories. The idea of being surrounded by other writers and being immersed in intense conversations with them, that has to be a very gratifying thing. And we talk a lot about the industry on this podcast and how much it's changed in recent years and how it continues to change. It seems like every year there's like a whole new way of looking at the publishing industry. I just wanted to start out by asking you about your experience with the publishing industry. I know you've already talked about the publisher in Australia of your new collection. But that seems to be a place that emerging writers come up against a lot of obstacles and pushback. So maybe you could just share some of your experiences, especially when you were starting out.
Well, I'll just start with now, actually, because something really wonderful has happened in the form of this book in Australia. The book in Australia is actually a compilation of three short story collections that I've published. And I was really surprised by what the publisher actually said to me when he accepted. I sent him my latest book, which is a collection of flash fiction published in the UK. And I sent him that, and he said, "Great, great, great, I want it." And then he said, "Oh, I see that you have published other short story collections. I would like to have a look at them too, with a view to publishing a selection, like a bumper issue of your short stories." And I think that's every writer's dream, so that the stories don't die, so that the book isn't, completely out of print and forgotten. So that's what's happened to me. So that's just to say, don't ever think it's over with what's published and out there. I mean, people could be interested in your backlist, and people can come back to you and say, "Hey, I would like to sort of see the shape of your work and produce something, a new volume with your work." So don't ever think that it's over. Because with promotion of a book, there's a tail, and there's sort of like a 6 month tail, and you push and you push and you push for 6 months, and then you know it's going to taper off. But I'm sort of starting with the end instead of starting at the beginning. So I'll go back to the beginning. In the beginning, my first short story was published, and my first short story was called Elton John's Mother. And it was about welfare mothers sort of milking the system in New South Wales, in Australia, where I come from. And it was a sort of take on mothers giving their kids pop star names. And it was quite silly, but it did really well. The story did well for me in Australia and got into a sort of best of selection. And that was a surprise to me. And that came out when my first kid was in a basket on the floor in Mogadishu. And it was pre-internet. So I was sending stuff off with, you know, typewriter and carbon paper, as we all did many, many, many years ago. So that's how long I've been at it and waiting, you know, the waiting for an acceptance or rejection. And it took me a really long time, though, to get a short story collection together, because I moved around a lot. I had children, and anybody who has children knows they take quite a lot of energy out of you. I was working too, so, you know, everything, upheavals, everything that happens. But I never stopped submitting short stories. And I would take all of the criticism on board. Some of the criticism I've had includes, this reads like a bad translation. So take it all on board, whatever people say to you. And editors can be really, really tough. And now I'm an editor myself. I've been an editor for 7 years for Litro. And okay, I would never say that to anybody, but that has been said to me. So take it all on board and listen. And I think with the short story world, it's very, you know, the connections are really important, because it's sort of smaller scale. It's not like we're talking big bucks and the big novel and the big launch anymore. I mean, well, not at my end of the spectrum, but I think connections are really important. And I think humanity is really important. And I also think the more you put into the bucket, the more you're going to get out. I really believe in karma. What you put in is going to come back to you. Mm-hmm. So if that means getting a rejection, say thank you anyway for putting, you know, for reading my work. That really rings a bell if somebody does that with me when I even reject a piece for work. And then the submissions road is really tough, because you're going to get 5%, 10% of the work that you send out accepted. And the rest of it is just like, no, no, I'm not interested, no. And so you've got to get used to it. Just get used to it. And then when you get the big rejections, like an agent just says, you know, after 6 months, no, just a no, like dead old no, nothing like that. I think you can allow yourself a bit of mourning and a glass of wine, but then I think you have to get on with it. Just get on with it. And know that with short stories, it's just going to be really, really hard. My first collection of short stories, I think the publisher said yes, because I already published a novel with him, and it was an erotic comedy, and it did quite well. So I know he believed in me. He saw that I could promote and I could talk and I could, you know, move. I think that's really important in the short story world in any country. I mean, there's not as many readers, because the short story requires a little bit more of a reader. And so you've got to put in a lot of work yourself. And so that's why he said yes, I think, for my first collection. And my second collection, I was working with an agent in London, and she loved it. She loved the stories. I think many of the stories are the ones that you've read. And she sent it out to the big publishers, and they all said, you know, yes, 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 but does she not have a novel? So I think so many short story writers come up against this sort of wall. Lovely work, you can write, but where's the novel? Because novels sell more. So I think that's just something you have to incorporate into your thinking. There's no point. This is how it is. So you just have to keep on writing, really, 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 writing your best stories, going with independent publishers, because there's plenty of them. As you say, publishing is changing. Every year there's a new crop of publishers everywhere. I think that's global. And I don't know, connect. I think connections are really important.
Yes.
And just keep at it and keep publishing, keep submitting, and don't give up.
Yes, it takes dogged perseverance from everything writers tell me. You have to have like this boundless faith in yourself, you know, that that eventually, you know, someone's going to read your work and really appreciate it in the way that you hope they will. Well, you know, we're going to talk today about stories from the cartography of others. Mm-hmm. Was that your second collection that was published in 2018? Mm-hmm. And that was, I'm very curious about how that was published. The company is Outbound. And it's crowdsourced, right? Is that what you would say?
Yeah. Otherwise, that book was just not going to be published. And I was not going to, because I knew it was a good book. And my agent knew it was a good book. But we'd sort of gone down from the big publishers down to the people who don't reply for a year. I mean, that type of thing. So this company, they did a really good editing job, great cover and everything. I knew they were really, really competent. But the crowdfunding, it was up to me. So, but I've worked as a secretary in a previous life. I've worked in business before. So I just put on my secretary hat and said, I'm going to do this. And I have, that's why I say connections are really important, because you never know who could help you or, you know, it's amazing what people will do for you if they believe in your work and if you give something back. I think it's the energy thing again. So I spent, I think the campaign was 90 days and you had to raise a certain amount of money, which I don't remember, but I know that I was tailoring that all of the emails that I wrote were tailor written. Like they were specifically written. I didn't just send off the same thing to everybody. I would think about what our connection was, what I could possibly entice them with the story. Also make it not involving money, but more involving belief in the project and belief in short stories. Because only so many people are going to respond to the whole short story scene anyhow. Some people are just not interested. Some people really aren't. And then some people really find off-putting the idea of crowdfunding. And if you don't have many options and... But it was okay. It was really hard work. I don't want to do it again. It was really, really, really hard work. They were great publishers to work with. They were extremely professional. And I managed to get really good cover comments. I got a cover comment from Hilary Mantel.
Yes.
She's very wonderful, generous person, amazing. Very sadly, she passed away 2 years ago, but she was amazing. And again, with the stories in that book, the reason why I knew they were, you know, publishable is because quite a few of them had done well in competitions. And that's another thing I would suggest to short story writers: enter competitions, and there's so many. Really, that's just, they're really good feathers to have in your cap when you're when you're out there looking for a publisher for a collection. And so I did, I actually raised the sum in 90 days. I was fine. I did it. And then, yeah, it became the editing. That took quite a long time. But the next book after that, Love Stories for Hectic People, it's a flash collection. So it's a different take on life. It's a different structure. It's a different sort of weight. It's almost like a lightweight book in comparison, because the stories are less dense because they have this sort of time frame. They're brief, these stories. And with that, I went with an independent English publisher.
Yeah, let's talk about the flash form. Because I know you've taught workshops on flash. And when people come to your retreat, are they writing both flash and longer form stories?
Some people both. I've actually had a group come here. They were an English group. They were already a writing group, and they came and they specifically wanted to do flash fiction lessons with me. So I did sort of a week of flash fiction lessons and made them, gave them prompts and made them produce work, and we did readings together. So it was full on. It was full on, and talked a lot about it. But mostly it was practical lessons, because I think you can only talk so much when you're teaching. You really have to get people sort of, get them moving inside of their brains and get them pulling ideas out and surprising themselves. I think that's where teaching is useful. You get people, I don't know, you sort of creep up on them from behind and get their brains going in a different way so that they surprise themselves. And that's the wonder of teaching. That's what I enjoy doing, getting strange things on the page.
Yeah.
So, but to answer your question, sorry, A lot of people do both.
Mm.
And we do talk about the differences because I think they're completely different forms.
Yes. And I want to talk about that because for me, I'm my real love is the longer form, and I've kind of come along to the flash form reluctantly, but I appreciate,
Reluctantly.
yes, but I do appreciate what's possible in the form, in the hands of really skilled writers. But it really is such a different animal to me. And I'm just curious about, I would think teaching Flash, it seems like there's more kind of technical skill required in writing Flash. So it would seem that it might be something that you have more to work with in terms of teaching writers. Does that make sense?
I think it's easier to teach Flash than short story. I mean, the common ground, really, I think, with teaching Flash and teaching short stories, perhaps, is that you have to know yourself, you know your voice, know your material, know who you are, know what you need to sort of dislodge in yourself in order to come up with something that's as original as possible. But let me tell you how I fell into Flash, because I also came to Flash reluctantly. I was unwilling to even sort of understand what the form was. My great love is short story writing as well, long form. That's where my heart always is. But I had a short story accepted by Litero magazine. I went to London to do a reading because it was their print version, and it's always great to do a reading to a live audience. And so I went and was asked by the editor-in-chief to join the team as Flash Fiction editor. And because I do feel as though I'm sort of living in this outpost in Italy where I don't speak English most of the time, that's probably why I'm talking so much. But I was asked to join, and I said, yeah, of course, of course. So I signed on and I started reading Flash Fiction because that was my job. And this was 7 years ago. And so that meant reading these 800-word stories and beginning to understand, okay, what's special? What's going on? What is this? And so I began to understand. And actually, towards the end of that year, I decided, oh my God, I better try and do this because it's just, I should try. I should give it a try. And I was having a terrible year with my youngest kid who didn't want to go to high school, et cetera. So I was driving him to school in Italy, being treated like a female on the road and coming home in a terrible mood. And so to get over that, I made myself write a 500-word story every morning in front of the fire. And that's how that book happened, because I sort of saw this path through the theme. The theme was love in its different forms and at different ages. And so that was my flash fiction path. That's when I started to write it and understand, oh, this is what I'm trying to do. But it's hard to sort of encapsulate, because I think a lot of flash depends on magic and depends on getting in the zone. It depends on voice and depends on that first note of the story. It's like a piece of music. Like, you've got to sing, you've got to sort of capture your audience's ear. So it's hard to explain, but either it works or it's flat. That's it.
And
That's it.
there was a quote that I was looking for and I couldn't find it, and it may have been from a piece that you had written in Litro about the form being sort of like a magic trick. And you mentioned magic just now, but I thought it was just perfect because in a successful Flash piece, it really can feel like someone has just performed this incredible magic trick in front of
No, I sort of remember that. It's sort of
you.
something you're either pulling it out of the hat or it's some sort of gymnastic feat. I think it does involve moments of magic. Anyway, that's for me. Maybe everybody's different, but that's how I feel that it happened. I mean, I've also seen it happen in front of my eyes because I do a lot of sort of coaching with Flash, because so many people are into it now. That's something that's changed, I think, in the short story world over the past 5 years. There's a lot more Flash writers and magazines. But don't worry, I'm still clinging to the short story. That's
Good.
still my favorite form.
All
And
right.
after this book, I actually have another book that's already ready.
Oh
It's just
my.
waiting in the wings. I haven't submitted it anywhere.
Wow,
And
you really don't stop ever, do you?
No. I don't have any excuses. Like, now I don't have to run after children anymore. And winter's long here. Winter's very long. I mean, I do travel a bit, and that's great. But I use my time. That's another really important thing, I think, with writing. You need discipline, and you need to know when your best energy comes, and you need to not let anybody interfere with your creative energy. The rest, it doesn't matter. Editing,
Mm-hmm.
social media promotion, that's different energy. But your real core energy, you shouldn't let anyone mess with that.
Yes, you hear that, writers who are listening? don't let them mess with that, because they will keep trying, right?
They will keep trying. Yeah. And don't give your ideas away and nourish yourself. I also think whenever I teach, I think writing is you produce your best when you're in the right frame of mind, and you even have to know what your particular right frame of mind is. I mean, for me, it means not being drunk and, you know, things like that. For me, it cannot involve anything from, you know, heavy nights before. It means a good night's sleep, and it means exercise and eating well. Okay, I drink lots of coffee. Don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, no, no.
But I think exercise is really important. Oxygen.
Yes.
All that stuff. So,
well, oxygen, that's like the perfect word. You know, when I think of your stories, they are just like full of like pure oxygen. I get that rush when I read them. And I read The Cartography of Others, like eating a, you know, a huge banquet, you know, after not having eaten for a week. I mean, it was just a feast. And I want to talk about those stories, because they are really remarkable. And
thank you.
Yes. And, you know, it's so cool that you got Hilary Mantel to do a blurb for the book. And she obviously loved it, rightfully so. The stories, they kind of move around, and they seem to be about places where you've lived, West Africa, Ghana, Australia, Italy, and they are so unusual, you know. And we talked, I think, in our first conversation about voice, and how I think writers from the British Isles, they just have a very different voice. And it's very hard to, you know, describe the difference between like the American voice versus the, you know, the British voice. But there is something about, you know, when I read even Canadian writers, you know, I just interviewed a really wonderful writer, John Delacorte, whose novel Provenance was just published. And, you know, it's Canada, it's America, you know, it really is part of the Americas. But there's just something in the tone and the use of language that is so different from what I read from American writers. And it's not to take anything away from the amazing work that American writers, you know, that I, especially the ones that I have on the program, do. But can you respond to that? Do you feel, do you kind of, I mean, I think you get what I'm talking about, right?
Oh yeah, there's definitely a different mood. And then I would say, you can't say anything generally, but some American writers are more direct with language. There's sort of this sort of pliable directness that just comes straight at you, perhaps. But then you think of William Faulkner, and that's not true. I mean, William Faulkner's language is so complex and layered. And English writing, again, it's really not fair to generalize, but yeah, it can be a tiny bit more restrained. I think, and when you read translations too, when you read European writers in translations, I think there's another sort of tone, there's another thing happening. And then if you read sort of African writers, because I've been reading African writers recently, there's another sort of tone and sometimes a very elaborate construction, and you know that's coming from, you know, the languages that people are speaking. But I do think that most sort of groups, I mean, nationalities, I guess, have a specific voice almost. And within that, many, 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 many voices.
Yes.
But that makes me feel a bit sort of on the outside, because I don't really know where I belong.
Well, that was what, you know, I was hoping you wouldn't feel, because I can see why you might. But I have an appreciation for it, because I grew up reading the classics. And I think, and that was what came from my conversation with John Delacorte, is that the British Isles, the tradition of the amazing, you know, wealth of writers going back centuries, obviously, you know, and in the British Isles, students begin absorbing this very early in their lives. So there's a whole tradition there
that is sort of in the zeitgeist. It's even in the DNA probably of people, you know, in the British Isles. So I think, you know, I'm sure that that has a lot to do with it. And I find your work to be very direct. You know, you deal with some very intense human circumstances and conditions. Yeah. You know, let's talk about some of the stories. Sensuality is like a hallmark of these stories. You've probably developed something of a reputation as far as that goes. Would you say? I noticed that you had taught a
yes.
I think it was a workshop, right, or master class Litro, Sensuality in the Short Story. And I love, I'm just going to read, you know, the little blurb here where they were offering, Litro was offering this course to writers. Why are some writers so original and alluring? Why does other sex writing make us cringe? How can your writing achieve balance and sensuality that engages the reader?
Yeah.
And that's a huge thing.
I think I wrote that. Well, the reason why, I'll tell you where that came from, because I this is pre-COVID, I used to go to the UK a lot, used to go to London a lot to do readings, because that's where most of my short stories were published. And if I were shortlisted in a competition, I would go and read and, you know, definitely attend as many events as possible and festivals too when the other book came out. And so I do have quite a few friends who are writers, and a few of them have said to me, oh, the way that you write about sex, how do you do it in this sort of embarrassed English way? And I mean, you feel no shame and it just comes out on the page. And so it just gave me this idea. I just thought, wait a minute, I can teach this. I can talk about it, because for me, talking about sensuality is essential. It's part of our being. It's part of our day, our activity, our, you know, relationships, everything. For me, it's always been like that. It's like gardening. I mean, it's got to be done. It's got to be talked about. It's got to be finished. So it doesn't really scare me off. And some of my favorite writers have, I feel that they have been sort of sensual in their use of language. I mean, whether it was directly about sex or not, it's not an obsession with sex. It's more about the senses, the actual senses. And so the course that I put together, because I was allowed to put everything together myself, that's what it begins with. I mean, that's what it was sort of based upon. You're being in touch with your five senses and producing writing that's 360 degrees. So not, it's not so much the sexual act. It's more about my body involving five senses, not just this type of writing that's very two-dimensional. Like, I get a lot of submissions, and you can see people watch the television too much. They watch Netflix too much. And it's all two-dimensional writing about sort of third-hand information. It's not lived. It's not real. It doesn't touch me. It doesn't make me feel anything. So that's where the course began. I thought, I'm going to do this. And actually, that particular course was hilarious. It was so much It was so much fun. They really, but they were so shy in the beginning. They were English and American students, very shy in the beginning and, you know, embarrassed about all. And then by the end, some of them came out of the closet. Some of them were making declarations. I mean, and they were writing really good work.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was great. It was a lot of fun. I think I'm teaching it again at the end of the year, but I don't remember the dates.
I was going to say, it sounds like something that you should be teaching on a regular basis.
It's good because when I teach the masterclass series with Litro, my objective is to for the students to end up having a piece of work that they're ready to submit. I mean, not just leave them hanging there with all of these ideas and talk. No, I want them to have something concrete that they can put out there, and even ideas of magazines that I think might be a good destination for their submissions. So that's really important, I think, to sort of keep this energy moving.
When I read the work of other writers, some are, their approach to sex and sexuality is so direct and so fearless. And others, I get the feeling that they're just, you know, they want to wade into it, but they feel like they have to kind of tiptoe around it, you know.
Yeah.
So it comes through, you know, in a very tenuous manner, and it's never quite as successful when it's handled that way.
No. A lot of people are really afraid of what other people will think. So it's about admitting that to yourself, I think, and deciding what you're going to do about with this fear. because it can really hold you back, not only with this sort of area of writing, but also with, you know, characters, themes. So I do think writing should involve a lot of looking into yourself and asking, why the hell am I doing this? What do I want to get out of it? Who am I anyway? And what stories do I really want to tell and why? I think we have to constantly ask ourselves this question, really.
Mm. Yes. People hear the word sensuality, I think their mind immediately goes to the sex part of sensuality, but you know, that's just really only a small part of sensuality. And in your work, in your work, it's everywhere. You know, it's in all of the senses and the characters and how they're experiencing the world they're in through all of their senses. And it even crosses over into, you know, the way people relate to their children and their children relate to them. So I think it's an apt way to look at your work, you know, because not everybody is as successful in conveying the feelings that the senses bring to us. And you are always surprising the reader as far as that goes. I do want to get into a couple of these stories specifically. And because you're dealing with many cultures in your stories, and it's clear that you've experienced these cultures intimately, I love the way the respect that you have for the cultures that you are writing about. You know, you write about experiences, you know, working for like an ad agency in Ghana, where the central character is male and is of mixed race, although we're not sure exactly, you know, what the mix is. But, you know, the world that he moves in, you just treat everyone with equal respect. And you are very clearly a very worldly person and have lived, you know, many lives in a way, you know. And so she says, rolling her eyes. But this is what brings all of this richness to your work. You know, I mean, you have all this incredible experience. I'm not quite sure, you know, how to word the question, but do you feel that you need to kind of go back to all these experiences and sort of ferret out some things, like unresolved things in the experiences that you had in these places, or
no, it's not really that, actually. Okay. It's not really me. It's not really me and my involvement with these contexts actually at all. It's my great joy is making up a story. So I'll take elements from what I've seen or lived or heard or listened to. I listen to everything and I steal stories from people. I definitely am always listening. And so it's not really about my experiences in Ghana. It's more, there were a couple of characters that I wanted to work with. And there was a context that I was familiar with. So I thought, okay, put this together. And then this sort of magic thing happens. This is the magic that we were talking about. The story gets, if it's going to, it'll grow legs. I mean, it'll take you somewhere. And a story like that, for example, the title, The Wild Beasts of the Earth Will Adore Him. I was working on a translation, I think from a book from Italian to English. And that actual phrase or sentence, it's a sentence really, it was translated into Italian from Latin, and it was on, say, like a tombstone in Vicenza. And that's where it came from, just to say, I fell in love with that line, okay? Mm. So I took it. Mm. And then I put these people together, and then the story happened. And the guy who dies is not somebody who exists. He's somebody who just walked into the story.
Mm.
And then the woman with the dogs, and then what happened with the dogs in the end, that has nothing to do with anything. They just all walked into the story, and the story just, like, I go into the zone. I don't know if everybody else does that. Maybe there's something wrong with me.
No.
I
think that's essential from what writers tell me. You know, I think the zone is where the best stuff comes from.
Sorry, I'll just do the end of that story. At the end of that story, okay, it doesn't matter if I tell people at the end, but I don't know if you remember the end of that story. The guy, all he can think about is getting home to his stash of dope in the law unit. That's all he can think of.
Yeah.
And so I gave this story to a friend to read, actually Greek, but perfect English, and he's a bit of a dope head. And he read the story and he said this to me. He said, "How do you know how somebody like that thinks? Because I'm not a dope head. I'm telling you, honestly, I'm not really interested in all of that." But he said to me, he said, "Kat, how did you know that that guy would be thinking that in that moment?" And I don't know. But you just go into the character, don't you? And then make it come to life and do your best. Because if you relied on your own experiences or trying to resolve that, then it would be a different purpose. And that's not really my purpose. My purpose is to invent something that other people are going to enjoy and believe, really.
In terms of believing, it's all so credible. And, you know, it's always remarkable to me when someone can write believably in the mind of someone of the opposite sex too. I think that it must be a challenge. I find that a lot of the writers, the women writers I have, tend to really stay in the woman's voice for the most part. I'm sorry, what was that?
No, I said me. No, I don't know why, but I like being a guy in the story. I think half of the stories have male protagonists or male first person or third person voices.
Yes.
And it's not deliberate. It's just, I think that's a storytelling device. I mean, you have that much more distance from the person who you want to make believable. So you do try and create them. You're not investing them with female traits because you're a female. I find female characters sometimes harder to portray because I don't want them to be anything like me. I want them to be real. So I don't know. I think it's the interest of the other, that type of thing.
Yes. Yes. Another story with a male protagonist is it Magali Park or Magali Park?
I don't know. Magali Park.
Yes, pronunciations, you know, especially when
I made it up, don't worry.
Oh, you did. Okay, so so I don't have to worry about accuracy then. I'm always very concerned about mispronouncing, you know, locations. Okay. But this is one of the few stories that's set in Australia.
Yes.
And it has a very different tone to the other stories. It's a very touching story about this young man who encounters this woman jogger who has just witnessed a murder in a brand new like housing development. It just kind of happened, you know, while she was out running, and it happened quickly, and she saw the assailant take off, and she was talking to the police, and this woman was very shaken up. And this young man, you know, who has a girlfriend, but you know, obviously there's some kind of attraction to this woman. He feels for her, you know, in that moment, and he goes up and just says, you know, how are you doing? That, you know, I saw what you just went through. That must have been really difficult. Yeah. And then they develop this relationship. And it's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you made up that park, that the name of that development. Okay.
No, actually, I didn't make up the murder. There was at my mother's house, because my mother lives on the water in Sydney, and she told me that there was a murder down there, but that's all I know. She just said that there was a murder down there, and then I made up everything else. I don't know. I'm interested in the idea of adoption and this otherness. I think otherness and suffering and being sort of misplaced. And so that's why I think I chose a character, because the girlfriend of the guy who's a swimmer, and actually I am a swimmer, so I guess that came into it too. But the idea of this adopted kid and the mother putting her under a lot of pressure. And then, yeah, very Australian characters. I think I just wanted to play with Australian characters.
Yeah, and the girlfriend, who is an adoptee, as you say, is from China. So she is already kind of forced to assimilate in ways that clearly have created challenges for her and challenges for their relationship, she and this young man. And it's a very complex story. But you get inside the mind of this young man in such a persuasive and compelling way. And yeah, and so again, this thing kind of just began with the ideas, and then these stories kind of take on a life of their own, it seems like.
For me, that's how it is. I don't know if everybody else is like that, but I shut myself off and I don't like any interference when I'm doing a short story. It's just like, it doesn't take me that many days, but then, yeah, it does take on its own life. I wrote a story when I had COVID last year because I was so upset about losing work time. And I also there, I got an idea and I just, well, I was in bed anyway, so I just worked on this story.
There is a story that you have written in honor of your dad in this collection, and that's the bamboo furnace, correct? Yes.
Yeah.
That seems like such a personal story. And the fact that you dedicated it to your dad makes me think that there's some historical fact in this. Is that true?
Actually, he read the story. He did pass away, and that wasn't meant to happen. But the story, I made the story up. It's not true.
Wow.
It's not true. But he did have a great uncle who was a missionary who went to the Philippines. My family's Irish Catholic, so there was always a priest, a nun, and a brother. And so he, my grandmother's eldest brother, he did go to the Philippines as a missionary. But I mean, they're all gone, that generation. God forbid, I would never say that he had a child in the Philippines. That's not true. He didn't have a child. Well, I don't know. But again, the story was, it just happened, really. Mm. But he was the person who, I'm sure I have a photograph of him somewhere, but I know that, yeah, there was somebody who went off to the Philippines and came back a very sort of wounded and changed man. He didn't lose his leg. That didn't happen. I made that up because I remember somebody, that flesh-eating bug thing, it did used to happen in Somalia, and I can remember one of the doctors I knew telling me about that. So I think that just stayed in my head. And that's something from living in the tropics. And then the sister, I guess the kitchen is my grandmother's kitchen, but the story is... it's not true. But my father, actually, what my father said, he also knew that the story wasn't true. But what he did say and why he loved that story is he said, you really captured Father Joe. That was his name. That was his real name, the old uncle, the missionary priest. He said, you really captured him. And I never knew him. I know nothing about him.
Wow.
I obviously could smell something.
That was my next question. So you never knew the man. You never met him. Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Nobody spoke about anything like that either, because I think it was too weird. I think these people who were sent away came home absolutely wounded, really. He didn't go through the war, but the ones who went through the war, they came back sort of shell-shocked. Like, I had some great uncles who fought in New Guinea against the Japanese, and I know that wasn't spoken about in the family. But also this guy, I know nothing about him. I just know that he was hardcore Catholic. That's all.
And did you not intend to have your father read this, or did you want your father to read it?
I did want my father to read this, and he really loved it. He really enjoyed it. He really loved that story. That's why I dedicated it to him, not knowing that, you know, there was a terrible thing that was going to happen, but because he really loved the story.
Everything that you write is steeped in this understanding of the human condition and, you know, what it means to try to live in this world. So every story, you know, was like an experience unto itself, and they all relate to each other in a way, but it's like the experience with each story is so unique and wonderful, and which is what I look for when I read a short story collection. I want to have a unique experience with each story. That doesn't always happen. And in linked collections, that's less likely to happen, but that's written in with a whole different intention. So, you know, you have to go into it knowing that. I could spend another hour easily just talking about one or two of these stories, Catherine. I want to say thank you so much for sharing these stories with me. And I want people to seek these books out because I think they will have an amazingly rewarding experience in reading these books. And I'm so excited that your new collection is coming out soon. And, you know, hopefully it will show up on all of our shores. But
hopefully,
as I said,
the US.
But whatever the case, we can always order it online. It's going to be available to everybody that way. So, remind us what the title of the new book coming out is.
It's called The Carnal Fugues.
Carnal Fugues. I love it.
Yes.
Well,
it has a lovely cover, actually, but I don't have the print of the cover, but maybe Yes, if people look for it, they'll see.
Yes, and maybe there's a way that I can share the press release somehow on the website, but I'll see what I can do in that regard. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy life, which I know is like, especially lately, it's been very busy. Say thank you. This has been so delightful. And I look forward to, reading more of your work and having other conversations.
Can I say thank you to you too, John, all the work that you're doing for short story writers and readers. It's wonderful.
I appreciate that. And I look forward to the next conversation, Catherine.
It's Me too. That was yes. great. All right. Thanks so much, John.
Ciao.
You'll find links to Catherine's stories and more information about her writing retreat in Italy on her website, CatherineMcNamaraWriter.com. And now we'll move on to the story. Today I'll be reading The Bamboo Furnace, which was first published in Southerly and was included in her award-winning collection, The Cartography of Others. So here it is, The Bamboo Furnace, by Catherine McNamara. He was sent back with a tropical bug eating through the flesh of his leg. They had tried treating the advancing wound with dry ice, but it hadn't worked. Further doctors came over from the Spanish mission, where one local man had had the skin cut away from his cheek, and his jaws now worked like a moist robot. When the limb began to putrefy, he was airlifted out to Singapore. They had to prise Sybil away from him, first from his chest, then the bedpost. There was grappling, and she was dragged screaming across the floor. In Singapore, they did the job. He found himself back in Brisbane, sitting opposite his sister Martine at the yellow formica kitchen table. Martine had tried to set up the house as best she could. She had taken out unwanted chairs from the years when the family had run riot, and given him their parents' double bed with its isolated hollows. She had put an extra chair in the bathroom, thinking it might serve for balance, or to lean the crutches on when he was relieving himself, so they wouldn't rattle to the floor. Lionel had shrunk while in the hospitals, though she could tell that until recently he had been robust. Much had been robbed from him, and now he had been felled. After their tea, she poured two glasses of beer, watching his sun-ravaged forearms and the shaven mold of his chin. He had come to her in civilian clothing, a shirt with small arabesques. 31 years ago, his cheekbones had been concealed in a puffy boy's face, but now they seemed crafted with ceramic grace. His ears had grown into fleshy rinds below his crew-cut. She was certain they had heard night sounds from bamboo forests and babbling voices from villages of half-dressed women. Lionel looked around the unchanged kitchen, remembering what was in the drawers, knowing that Martine would keep her bills clamped by a wooden clothes peg as their mother had, with the fabric-covered shirt-box full of photographs underneath. She would have followed her ways with little modulation. Martine's whole aspect had broadened, where a woman like Sybil would spend her life becoming fine-boned and minute. He had forgotten how white women aged with such symphonic slowness. On the sideboard behind his sister's attentive curls were cedar-wood-framed photographs of the clan who had driven him to the port. Their faces had stayed creased with pride these long years, a vigil in serge suits, as the cancers and heart failure had pulled them down one by one. He saw himself in their midst, just 6 months after being ordained, a shiny-faced buck gripping the rail. He remembered how they had posed along the ramp up to the rusty ship, squeezing his hands, and their tipsy embracing. How they had touched him that day, daubing his new clothes, anointing him. He could still feel his father's hand grasping his shoulder and its repugnant demand for salvation. He had ridden the old man's pride like a show pony. His mother could not be convinced to make the trip that day. She'd known she would never lay eyes upon him again. A week into the voyage, he had caught typhus and landed in Manila, a ruin, his gut and whole equilibrium off balance for years. He had suffered the boat south to the islands. Mules were ridden. He no longer remembered much. Two black-haired brothers in cassocks had left him at the outpost that would become his contracted world.
"Would you like some more beer?" Martin asked. "Of course. Yes, thanks."
Martin went to the fridge, and Lionel envied the way she had stayed close to this earth. He could see how the shape of her life had drawn down her shoulders and made a dense slab of her back, a broad swimming bundle of her rear. In all these years, he had rarely thought of his sister, or her placid tragedies. Martin noticed how he no longer wore the silver ring they had given him at the seminary. In the past, she had studied this ring on his fourth finger, inscriptionless and rounded, a talisman that said he was bound to them. As children, she and Lionel had run off from a picnic and followed a trail to the river where willows swung, and a boy had drowned, trapped in their roots. Lionel had gained the knowledge that their mother would produce no more babies. Martin had watched his arc of piss against a tree. They saw the upriver ferry pass homesteads on the other bank, and the wash pleating murky water. A great aunt of theirs had lived in one of those homesteads.
Martin knew this aunt had been rich and vibrant once. She'd seen sepia photographs of a striding woman in fur collars and button-down shoes.
But Lionel had told her that as soon as she died, their father would buy a new motor car. After the operation, there had never been any question of Lionel going back to the seminary on the coast. Deirdre had said more than once she couldn't understand how Martin could take a stranger into her house after 31 years, even if he was her amputee brother and a priest. It was Deirdre who had made the largest inroad into her life. Deirdre's kids were her godchildren. At 18, straight after Lionel left for the Philippines, she'd started going into the city to work. Deirdre Sheldon was in her typing pool, and Deirdre's sandy-haired fiancé, Sten, was a building contractor who'd come out from Hungary and learned the language. They would go out with Sten's friend Tito, and it was jolly. Tito soon unraveled the first confines of Martine's womanhood, but then disappeared from their quartet. By that time, Deirdre was already throwing up, and one evening in the car, Sten apologetically ran his heated, level hands over Martine's breasts, and through the gestation of each of her godchildren, he had booked a room for them by the river. When Deirdre's third child, Christopher, was born, Sten had paid to extinguish the embryo in Martine's womb.
"Could there be a little food later on?" her brother asked as he closed the newspaper. "I think my appetite may be returning."
Martin knew how he relished peas and lamb chops. Lionel often became aware of the tingling moistness of the wound and felt razors of fear. If the cells reignited in his body, to whom in this tight-lipped, fair-eyed country could he release his cries? The Spanish priests had understood him, with their clipped beards and their hollering offspring in the compound. One had wiped his face and heard his mutinous confession. When the cut had first begun to fester, Lionel couldn't believe the jungle had turned on him. He had seen these open wounds char the life of a man, yet he knew what he had done. He knew it was his years of fondling Sybil under the netting, and the children he had seeded in the low sling of her belly. All but one of them had been taken back, pulseless remains Sybil had buried while he raised leaden arms to his god. Even the fifth child. He'd had no faith in the thriving creature until he recognized Martine's hardy genes. The day the baby girl reached 6 months, a wrinkled letter was spat out of the jungle. It told of his father's long-ago death and burial at St. Anne's. Reading and rereading his uncle's letter, Lionel thought of the rank casket at rest within the earth, and blind worms weaving through the old man's flesh. It was a shock to discover his daughter, Candide, had been born the very evening his father had passed away. With that knowledge, Lionel had gone on a bender for days. He had thrashed through the bamboo furnace beyond the village, tormented by the passage of their two souls in the underworld. Sybil, feeding the voluptuous baby, did not stir when Lionel stumbled back into the compound 3 days later. She knew Lionel had glanced at her through the eyes of the buried cadaver. She knew he had seen her as a cheap yellow belly holding a half-caste child. Lionel was sitting out on the veranda, reading the Courier Mail, with his head tilted back and his stump on the side table.
It was the first time she had seen the tortured limb with its cranky purple sutures. Lionel brushed away a fly. She saw this was an introduction he had planned. He cast over another page of the newspaper.
You don't think you should cover that?
Cover what? Oh, Lord, and now to name it.
Your leg, Lionel. It looks as though it might still be weeping.
Yes, perhaps you're right. There are bandages next to my bed. He watched the skirmish on her face, heard her steps along the linoleum strip through the house, heard the squeaky wood strut nailing down the carpet in his room. She was searching through his drawers now. One day she would find the photograph of him with Sybil and Candide standing in front of the cooking sheds. She would sit across from him, holding the quavering photograph, and she would have to be told. But Lionel had never been able to name what he felt for the fine-boned woman. Even as the plum babies died and he held Sybil's deflated body, he had felt a coreless alarm that was outside of his understanding. Martine came onto the veranda with the bandages. Lionel looked at her unrolling the white cloth. Until it happened, she would be his foot soldier, his unknowing Magdalen.
Is this comfortable?
He winked and she brought him tea. Martine lay awake, worrying about her visitor and this coda to their lives. He floundered along the hallway, but his face was a resilient bronze, and his eyes, equipped with untold visions, would close their soft shutters. She knew the same blood ran through them, and it was unalloyed. At night, this duality bobbed through her. Deirdre was right when she said that Martine didn't have a clue who Lionel was anymore, and Martine had never considered that there might be good priests and bad. Deirdre had said flat out she wanted to meet Lionel, said she'd shake him down in an instant, but even after all these years of depleting discretion, Martine never admitted Deirdre too long into her house. She found the photograph. She came out one afternoon with the image of the Filipino woman tucked under Lionel's arm, a solid barefoot child between them.
Who are these people?
This is my common-law wife, Sybil, and our daughter, Candide.
A daughter?
Candide is now 14 years old. She was born the day father died.
You got to be bloody joking.
Martine stormed back inside and stayed there an hour. She sat at the kitchen table, her shock rolling over and rising in twists. She returned to the veranda with a dark brown bottle of beer, filled their glasses in a disorderly way.
We thought you were pious, she said.
Lionel looked out over the patch of ground he had sprung from, the gormless youth grown into a deplorable messiah.
In the middle of the grass stood a thick-limbed frangipani tree, and his eyes exulted in the blossoms. I'm glad that you now know of them, he said.
She picked up the photograph again, looked at the woman wearing a gaping cotton shift, skin as yellow as rubber tight over her face, eyes that flickered. All those years her brother had lived among them, she had never pictured their individual faces. They were a submissive mass, she'd thought, chanting and weaving. And yet here was Lionel on an ill-lit day in front of sheds somewhere, and stripes of bamboo forest gushing from one side,
with a woman who looked like she belonged to him,
and he to her. Martine traced the line where their clothing melded and saw that Lionel's enveloping arm promised loyalty, and the treasured child bore their own family bulk and possibly Lionel's torment. She wished he had not given them names, wished they had never come here with him.
You're just going to leave them there?
I don't know, currently. This house is large enough.
Martine didn't know what she was saying now. She didn't want a pair of Filipinos in this house. It struck her then that her brother had not given her a thought in decades. He had left her a woolly-headed girl over the washing tubs, steam wetting her face. The years had poured over her, and her letters to him had been unwanted vials of news. A cyclone along the coast, their school burned to the ground, three friends in a car wreck. Martine looked at the stump again and wondered what implement modern doctors had used to carry out their barbarism. Those three times Deirdre was with child, Martine's life had become gilded. Sten would collect her at the corner after work. Then they would drive to the guest house by the river. In accented child speak that collected along his throat, Sten said the house belonged to another Hungarian.
Martine never saw anyone else, but when she washed afterwards, she would hear door latches or wood sighing. By the open window, Sten told Martine she reminded him of someone, and she felt a lyrical, feminine pleasure. When he mounted her, Martine would strive to vacate herself, leaving the cast of her body on the sheets, allowing him to heave into this lost woman. Deirdre had met Sten at the German club when he was just off the ship, and 2 years later she finished his obtuse sentences and told Martine in the kitchen she wished to God she had married an Australian. After Christopher's birth, Deirdre had her tubes tied, so there was no need for Sten to take Martine to the river anymore. Besides, for months after the abortion, Martine felt unfit. She would drive across the suburbs to Deirdre's and take boisterous Christopher into her arms, shedding gulps. Sten no longer addressed her and seemed ashamed those afternoons had ever occurred. They sat drinking whiskey under the awning after rain showers. Martine had returned the photograph to his drawer, but Lionel knew that Sybil and Candide now stood in silence behind his chair. He could see Martine observing their trio, barefoot. Martine scratched bites on her long, sturdy legs with stray blonde hairs. Her calves were a splatter of scabs. They stared out over the back garden, with its radiant yellow frangipani blossoms and beds of tossed, wet flowers. Beyond the fence there were rowdy neighbors, who kept a crop of car hulks in the unkempt grass. At times the youngest son would rap tools against metal with a deranged ferocity. A bank of Norfolk Island pines released needles into both gardens. Lionel hadn't thought of their lives ahead except to assume that staying with Martine would be bland and safe. It was critical now that he understood motion and how he would newly walk. His cropped nerves and arteries had barely learned that the leg was no longer there to be nourished. His removed foot, how its absent articulation pulsated at night. Each dense day that passed, Lionel could feel the humid jungle slipping behind him. Sybil had always known that he would be reclaimed. She had spoken these words in corrosive bells over his sun-beaten hide, her tiny body mauling him. As Candide grew tall, Lionel had seen the Irish grit that lay under her face, beneath the fine Asian plains. He knew the young woman would lumber through the village with her skewed features to stare at fading photographs in the community church. She would see her father in his worn vestments. She would imagine her parents rutting in the leaky shack. Nothing could shame Lionel more than Candide's harrowed being. Martine had suggested bringing the pair of them out here, but he could never have them where they would become shadowy, disregarded chattels. When Martine went to the shops, he limped over and took up the framed pictures of the young priest. His eyes studied that fair, fatty face. He recalled reverberations of prayer in his skull, yet as soon as they departed, his belief had yielded to the sea's rocking template and the explosions of his bowels. None of them had had an inkling where they were sending him, into what morass, into what inferno. He was simply left there, banished, all those years extricated from him. He recalled the first infants he had buried in rice sacks, the men slung into pits. The villagers had always known that he was no more than a quaking servant before the great beams of the forest. Sybil, a young widow designated for the white priest by the village, had crawled into his bed one night.
"I'd like to understand," Lionel said as they had drinks on the veranda. "Why I was sent away from here."
"Why you were sent away?" replied Martine.
"It was father's idea, mostly."
"You seem so almighty, then. That's what we thought of you."
"If I think back, I felt no particular calling, and I was sent to the most degraded outpost."
"Even so, I don't know why it had to come to that, Lionel. A woman and a child."
"You know, I nearly died on that passage," he told her.
"We were not informed. We prayed for you."
Martine remembered she had cried a river when he left. Then there were Deirdre and Sten and Tito. Her own ghastliness had begun.
"And now it seems I have returned like a man from battle. And what war was this?"
"Lionel, they are all dead now. All of them."
"Yes.
I believe I have done worse, she said loosely.
He found his eyes had gone to her cotton-clad thighs. Martine assumed a rare billowing nakedness in his thoughts that he shunned.
You might wish to confess.
To you? I could never. But he would always be detained by this point.
What crime did you commit? He asked.
Tell me. As Lionel stared, he saw her face become a pale enamel.
I aborted a child.
Lionel's eyes blazed.
The father was married.
Yes.
Then we are not equal.
He stood up on one leg, hand bulging upon the armrest, and slapped her face, fell back into his chair and pinched his eyes.
Please go inside, Lionel said.
He apologized to her. He said it was the alcohol and the sense of wrongdoing that had burst through him. His words drifted through her head. They entered and flew about. But after Sten's years of silence, Lionel's slap had not been an injury. She had walked up to her room and sat down on the bed, palm to the burning cheek. In circles, she heard their words on the veranda. I aborted a child. Then we are not equal. She saw Lionel's torso rise over her as the decades snapped, and the atrocious truth crawled back into her being with its bloody fist. All these years she had heard Deirdre complain about her kids as these joyful children ran around the wooden house on stilts and swung from trees. All these years she had watched Sten go to the tool shed underneath as soon as she arrived. And Lionel hadn't even had to ask twice because she had wanted to feel her soul scalded. Her admission had been waiting for him. She gave Lionel his tea. She cooked his bacon. She glanced at the stump on the small table. It looked dry. It was healing. Lionel's odyssey was perhaps coming to a close. They sat in the heat of the morning. He handed her the newspaper, and she read it through. There was a murder in the north. A woman's body parts had been found along an estuary. A ship had run aground on the sandbar off Stradbroke Island. The neighborhood was soundless except for cars up on Weller's Hill Road. She brought more tea, then a beer for them both. In the afternoon, she said she'd like to drive him into the city for a look around, and he agreed. The car wove through suburban streets of more wooden homes on stilts, cages of shade beneath, gardens with electric flowers. Further bushland had been colonized, and there were new thoroughfares busier than before, and bricked buildings on corners with loud signs she didn't care to point out. He attempted a walk along the block near the town hall, but after a few hundred yards his armpits, with the crutches driven into them, were soaked, and she could smell his sweat. His stump swung between the crutches and his healthy leg, a pendulum attracting stares. The sun beat on their faces, and the cafeteria she had wanted to visit was still far off. They returned to the car. He threw his head back on the seat and was silent.
"Shall we go to the river? The place we used to?"
He nodded. Martine drove through traffic over the new bridge, finding the municipal park, which had been cleared of undergrowth after some riverbank murder. The homesteads fronted up on the other side along the brown water, iron fretwork and corrugated roofs soon to be bulldozed away. But as she pulled on the handbrake, Lionel shook his head and said he wouldn't be getting down. He gazed at the river. Martine stepped out and walked a few paces. The air was loamy. She turned back to her brother's face in the windscreen, and the sky, with its thunderous contours, pushed upon the car. Lionel smelled the eddying water. He saw a mudslide entering a school hut, a father dragging out a child by the leg. He saw a woman pouring water into a son's eyes, the boy's face illuminated. She came around to him and said,
"Do you remember Great Aunt Joan, who lived on the other side of the river?"
"I do."
"You told me that Father bought a new car with her money, that he'd been waiting for her to pass away."
"I recall."
He looked at Martine's arms crossed over her dress. He found he did not regret slapping her cheek, for in her culpable eyes he had seen two paradigms of consent. Through Martine and the years cast between them, and the idols both had coveted and smashed, Lionel would understand whether he had ever been a priest. She drove him home, handed him his crutches lying on the back seat of the car, followed his exhausted catapulting down the side path by the fishbone ferns. She unpinned her hat in the hallway.
Martine brought him a mold-spotted letter with stamps from the Philippines. Lionel recognized his daughter Candide's handwriting. Martine left him alone on the veranda, launching back through the house, where she went into Lionel's room and took the photograph of his family into her hands. She wondered if she could induce some supply of sentiment towards the Filipino woman and her daughter, but no new emotion presented itself. Lionel's wife looked out from her triangular face as though she could foresee Martine sitting disrupted on her lover's bed. The woman's shoulder and black hair were eased into Lionel's shirt, a coastline against his shores. Martine trembled to think of the wedding of landscapes. Lionel read through Candide's poor, devastating English. Sybil had taken ill. He hurtled through the tenses he had taught his daughter in the shack. She is very bad sick, close to die. But almost immediately he understood that Sybil had been restored to good health, that this was just an aggrieved call sent out by his daughter. The page fell to his incomplete thigh. For years that he groped towards now, on nights that were summits, another man had propelled his body. But after the heft of fornication, this man would desert him. Then Lionel would see Sybil's slight hands flitting over utensils, her bottom and the purse between her legs. He would call out to her to cover her body, while she would just as easily come over and coil into him. Lionel shouted all the way through the house to Martine's room, where she lay turned to the wall. The youth next door was hitting metal against metal among the derelict cars, and this, as well as the memory of his rugged wanting, had made him enraged. Martine's bare feet thudded outside, ready to hear of some crisis.
"Everything as it should be?"
"Your neighbors."
"Yes, that's the young son."
"It should be stopped."
"It will stop soon enough."
Martine glanced at the nub of his leg dressed in scribbled pages, a distant frontier. Over and over she saw the word she. She. The metallic noise stopped, resumed, then ceased. A back door swung shut. She brought out refreshments, but saw that Lionel would not confide in her and drag her to his depths.
"You used to have your music," he said.
"I sold the piano."
"They are difficult to keep in tune."
Martine stood, hands loose at her sides. She reached for her pruning scissors and went to cut flowers. In the evening, she heard Lionel showering as she held the telephone receiver to her ear. It was Deirdre, marching through the conversation. But Martine heard protective tones in her own voice.
"He's in shock. He's hardly present."
"He hasn't said anything?"
Deirdre's voice came through a warp.
"No."
"Do you think there was a woman? For goodness sake, he was in the jungle for 30 years. There must have been a woman."
"There was no woman."
"So the man is a saint? I don't believe for a minute."
"He is not a saint."
Deirdre wished to visit them, and Martine was terrified her statuesque Holden would roll up their drive. She told Deirdre they were leaving on a trip to Bribie Island for a week or so, as Lionel's wound required the sea air. But Deirdre had already tired of the conversation and was lamenting her husband Sten's fanciful yearning for a boat. Lionel looked for his face in the steamed mirror, wiped away cloud, saw eyes and bones. If the disease were to return, he would welcome its advance. He would beg Martine to bury him as a pagan with coins on his eyes. Sitting outside, Martine listened to his clopping through the house. She sipped her whiskey, legs outstretched, ankles crossed. The smell of frangipani was a low, sweet stench. All along the neighborhood, a line of Norfolk Island pines had been planted, and these now thrust beyond the roofs. They were brooding, dark-willed trees that other householders had taken to with saws. Lionel appeared in the doorway. He lay down the crutches, lowered himself into the chair, propped his stump on the table. He poured whiskey into his glass.
"This is where our lives began," he said.
"Yes."
Martine looked at the glowing tree in the middle of the garden, the beds of gerberas and hibiscus and zinnias muted by the night, their sorrowful Eden. Thank you, Catherine, for allowing us to read that atmospheric and poignant story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Eleonora Balsano, The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories, I'll find you. Hold your tongue, boy.